Kenosha 29 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll get to today's interview in just a moment. We want to remind you that if you are interested in exploring past morning shows, one of the best ways to do that is to explore the morning show archive. It is found on our website, WGTD.org. It sits right on the front page to the right of the screen. And if you take a look, you'll find that morning show archive that goes back actually quite a few years. So if you're interested in just exploring, just sit down, take a look at our website and that archive, and you will find some really, really fun morning shows from the past. Also, we remind you that the morning show is also available to you as a podcast. And with the morning show podcast, you can actually enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week, including morning shows from the archives from way, way back that we will replay on the weekends. It's a really fun way to explore some older shows. In order to subscribe to the morning show website to podcast, you want to look for the morning show with Greg Berg. Don't just look for the morning show, because you'll find 70 or 80 different podcasts that bear that name. But there's only one morning show with Greg Berg, and it's available through Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. On to today's morning show interview. Hope you enjoy this. We'll spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a really entertaining and thought-provoking book that's called What's What and What to Do About It: Answers You Didn't Know You Wanted to Questions You Didn't Know You Had. This book is the creation of one Steve Adams under the pseudonym of Waldo Mellon. And Steve Adams is an experienced screenwriter, and to some extent a frustrated screenwriter who has taken to a very different kind of writing with this particular book published by Seven Stories Press, in which he delves into a wide array of different questions and topics and issues related to life, the world around us, how we see the world, how we see ourselves. And some of the questions approached are actually quite profound and serious, but all of them done with a really lovely light touch, and in almost every instance we are given a very different, refreshing sort of take on maybe time-worn questions that we have pondered many, many times before. It's a really, really great book. I've enjoyed reading it so much, and I'm excited for this opportunity to speak with the author. Steve Adams, Under the pseudonym of Waldo Mellon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, that was a breathtakingly lovely introduction, and I'm so grateful for the attention you're paying to this crazy little book.
Before we talk about the book, I do want to talk for just a little bit about the fact that you have spent so much of your life and paid the bills for the most part as a screenwriter, and and even have had several of your screenplays transformed into film. So you've enjoyed some success as a screenwriter, but in some respects, you've also experienced some frustration with kind of the genre itself. Tell us a little bit more about writing screenplays, being a screenwriter, and why your soul was kind of crying out to maybe do a different kind of writing this time around.
I'm a very slow writer, so it takes me a long time to write a screenplay, and the first screenplay of mine that got a lot of attention was a screenplay called Envy. And it was made into a movie with, it had big stars in it, Jack Black and Ben Stiller and Chris Walken. And Barry Levinson directed the thing. And I must say, I loved the screenplay, but I did not like the movie. And I had not seen that movie since the first time I watched it. It was just a painful experience. And that was followed up by two other produced screenplays of mine that in which I had the same experience. I was really proud of the screenplay, but in collaborating with these other good-hearted, wonderful people, something from my point of view was lost. And so I've had three screenplays produced, and they're screenplays that I feel apologetic for because they're just not what I had hoped for. And that's, on one hand, it paid for the life that I've lived, and it's been I'm living where I want to live, and I'm looking out the window where I got married and I have two grown children. And so it's been a wonderful life. But as you suggested, I'm unhappy about the creative trail I've left behind. And so I think that frustration accounts for wanting to find fun once again in writing. Mm-hmm. And stumbling across this idea, what if I wrote a fake advice column? And that seems fertile with comedy, which is what I'm comfortable writing. And the more I sunk into this, the more I did it, a fake advice column written by a fake advice columnist, a guy named Waldo Mellon, me, and now I have the opportunity to have all these fake letter writers ask this guy Waldo Mellon questions which I, in fact, ask myself. So it was a writer's dream come true that I could be funny, but at the same time answer serious questions.
Hmm. I did read or hear you say in talking about your life as a screenwriter for kind of all the frustrations that have been part of it, that say the writing of screenplays has been for you a terrific teacher. What are the most important things you've taken away from your career as a screenwriter, and especially how did that serve you in writing your new book, What's What and What to Do About It?
It made me aware of from the start what my strength is. Because as a young guy, you set out and I'll write a screenplay, and you get the form down, and you set out writing screenplays according to the confines of the form. And what I really found great pleasure in was dialogue, creating characters that talk to each other, a reality that wasn't farcical, but it was real. And within that reality, I would write a screenplay which was generated by my life experience, the things that I was going through in my life. I had no appetite for research, and so everything I've ever written has come from my assessment of what's true. And I think the writing of screenplays mostly taught me that I love character. I don't feel strong in storytelling, but I do feel strong in funny characters who are rooted in reality. And so this book, this little book, began as an experiment. And the more I did it, the more fun I was having. And I must say, I'm delighted with this book. I'm surprised by how much I love it.
Hmm. One other question, a little aside of the book itself, and then I promise we'll start digging into what's what and what to do about it. You
feel free to wander anywhere.
You mentioned in your biography that you lost your parents when you were quite young, and went to live with a relative. And those relatives were the Vonneguts. And I wanted to ask you about Jane and Kurt Vonnegut, because I actually recently recorded an interview with their son, Mark, who is a doctor and has written a memoir about his life as a doctor. So I just have to take this opportunity to ask what it was like to be raised by the Vonneguts. You hint that it explains a lot about who you are and how you see the world.
I think more than that particular experience, particularly for me, it wasn't so much that it was Kurt Vonnegut, but it was the time when my parents died. I was 11 years old. I had three brothers, and my parents died 2 days apart. And so you wake up from that, and there's relatives in your house taking care of these orphaned children. And so as an 11-year-old, what I remember most is jumping in a car and then getting out of that car on Cape Cod with my brothers and our dogs. And and there was this, my uncle Kurt, who's my mother's brother, who I knew the guy as a kid, because we would visit them on Cape Cod while I was living in New Jersey. But it was such a surreal experience, getting out, finding my new bedroom, and just navigating this brand new life. And so the fact that it was Kurt Vonnegut and Jane Vonnegut, they were really, they felt like more hosts than replacements for my parents. And I know my brothers have much different version of those days, but that's mine. That I have a new life. I'm sleeping in a different bed. The bed that I, bedroom that I shared, was the bedroom of Mark Vonnegut, who you interviewed. Both he had his book and my book came out almost simultaneously, and they're quite different. But to this day, I love my cousins. Like I love my brothers.
Hmm. Small world. Well, I'm so happy to know a little more about you. So for those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Steve Adams, who the world has known as a screenwriter until the publication of this new book, which is called What's What and What to Do About It, Answers You Didn't Know You Wanted to Questions You Didn't Know You Had. And in this book, Steve Adams, under the pseudonym of Waldo Mellon, answers questions as an advice columnist would, except he is responsible for concocting both the letters and the answers. One of my questions, Steve Adams, is kind of what the process was like in terms of how the book took shape. I mean, did you have the answers first and then have to figure out what question did this answer, or did you begin with questions and then formulate the answers, or was it all kind of a messy stew that you had to sort of sort out?
I would say it's a messy stew that I had to sort out. There were, I have a habit of, I carry a little notebook around my back pocket, and there's fragments of things that if I don't write down, I will forget. And it's from that notebook that lots of the questions originated. And so I would say on big issues, I had my answer, a version of my answer ready to go, and then I would tailor a letter writer, that person's question, to what I hoped to say. But often I had this experience that once the question was asked, an answer I never would have thought of came from it. And it was a wonderful experience to ask myself a question that I really wanted to know the answer to, and find a satisfactory answer to it. So it was the self-examination of it was an absolute pleasure. The writing of the letters was great fun because it could come from a junior high school girl. It could come from an old man. And you ask a great question. I think by writing the answers, I discovered what I really thought about things. And because I have great affection for this little book I'm holding in my hand.
I like that. Although it's interesting, at one point you say that something to the effect that if you ever needed to clear out a movie theater, the second best way after yelling fire is to yell out, would anyone like to hear my philosophy on life? Which points to, you know, in a sense, I wonder what your mindset was as you shaped this book. And, you know, with that idea of I'm just me, and as you say yourself, I am an expert on absolutely nothing but me. So what does it take to sort of get from that point A to point B, where you are, in effect, sharing your perspectives on life with the whole world via this book?
Yeah. I think the first big part of the trick was not being Steve Adams, being this guy, Waldo Mellon. And so Waldo Mellon feels like, almost like, I'm the ventriloquist, Steve Adams is the ventriloquist, and I've got this guy, Waldo Mellon, sitting on my knee, and I ask the questions, and Waldo Mellon, not me, gives the answers. And so it kind of deflects the notion that, oh, this guy Steve Adams, who's not a psychoanalyst, he's not a professor, he's a comedy writer, why should I listen to what this guy says about important issues? And by having Waldo Mellon, who I think of Waldo Mellon as myself in a terrific mood, and when he's giving advice, it's much more confident. It's much more. It has much more of a playfulness than I feel that I do when people ask me serious questions. I feel slightly apologetic about the fact that all I really know about is me. And in the shape of this advice column, me is plenty. And so I'm going to stick with it for a while. I like this little charade.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about your pseudonym, Waldo Mellon, which also, in a sense, is something of an alter ego for you. That you have shared with the world on certain occasions while ridiculously garbed. But let's start with, first of all, the name, where that pseudonym or nickname comes from. If I remember correctly, you were nicknamed that by a friend many years ago.
Yes. I was in college, I was in a rock band, a bunch of clumsy amateurs with instruments who would play at fraternity parties. And so while we weren't terrifically good, we had a lot of fun, and people could see that we were having a lot of fun. And our lead singer was a guy who I'd never met a personality like this. He was fun. He was funny. He was filled with energy. And he gave us all fun fake names: Mort Philpod, Orville McCorkle, and I was Waldo Mellon. And 35 years ago, this beautiful guy killed himself. And the name Waldo Mellon, I kind of tucked it away for when I wanted to bring him out. And this house that I'm sitting in, I look out in the yard. We used to have these a talent show every August, and neighbors and friends would come and sit out there in lawn chairs and blankets. And I'd become this guy, Waldo Mellon. I dressed up in a crazy outfit. I had lightning bolts painted onto my leotard. And I was the MC. And there was something very freeing about being that goofball. And the name, with the name Waldo Mellon, became useful once again when I wanted to create a fake, a fake advice columnist. And so that's where it came from.
We're speaking with Steve Adams, who under the pseudonym Waldo Mellon has given the world a really interesting book called What's What and What to Do About It: Answers You Didn't Know You Wanted to Questions You Didn't Know You Had. And there are a lot of different chapters in this book touching on all kinds of things from marriage to love to luck to fighting to horrors to crying to opinions to decisions, on and on and on. It's just such an entertaining book, start to finish. You begin in a really interesting place by sharing with us a word that you have coined, and that word is voucule, spelled V-O-O-C-U-L-E, which in a nutshell, I think you would define as one's bubble of life. Tell our listeners more about this idea of the voucule and why you wanted to start your book there.
It's a hard concept to talk about without actually reading it. I feel clumsy talking about it.
If you want to read at least a portion of that, I think that would be great. I thought this was a really interesting part of the book.
You tell me when to stop. I don't know how much time you have, but I'd be delighted to set out on this chapter. It's the first chapter of the book. All of the chapters are in that advice column form. There's except for this one. There's a letter written to me and then to Waldo, and then Waldo answers it. But here is the first chapter of the book, which is not a start with a letter. It's a brand new word. Before we get to the real heart of this book, to the letters, I want to introduce to you a brand new word. This brand new word is voucule. Here's how it's pronounced. Vu rhymes with boo. Cule rhymes with mule. Voucule. Say it a few times. Voucule. 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 I'm hoping that the word will become as much a part of your vocabulary as the word soul. Like your soul, your vocule is a tough butterfly to net. It cannot be seen or touched or even located. Every living thing has its own vocule, plants included. Your vocule is your bubble, your bubble of life. What's inside? You, the totality of you. Every experience you have ever had, every thought, every dream, everything remembered, everything forgotten, everything hidden in the dark of your subconscious, everything you hate about yourself, everything you love about yourself. And here's a very interesting fact. Every vocule is exactly the same size. The vocule of a baby mouse is no smaller than the vocule of, say, Gandhi, or an oak tree, or Elvis. How about that? And get this. You, and only you, can see what is inside your vocule. Do you see what this means? It means that you cannot see what is inside anyone else's bubble, which means that no living thing can see what is outside its own vocule, which means that all living things exist in separate vocules, an infinite and miraculous flotilla of wondrous magical bubbles that can enter each other but must always remain separate, which means, oh dear, every living thing is sealed in its own vocule, isolated and forever alone. I'm sensing that the fabulousness of my groundbreaking concept might not, at the moment, be making itself evident. Greg, and it goes on, and I'm, if you want more, I love reading this stuff. It's up to you.
It's one of my favorite parts of the book, and I think you're really on to something really interesting. And what you go on to say a little after that is that when we understand this about ourselves, that there is this thing, the vocule, our own little bubble of life, you say it helps us feel a greater sense of a shared struggle to be understood. In other words, it underscores, in a sense, the profound isolation that all of us feel on some level, even if we're not necessarily fully conscious of it. And knowing that, in a sense, can really make us, in a sense, more sympathetic to one another, and maybe more patient with one another, because we're all, in a sense, trying to deal with this world while living within our own vocule.
Greg, I got to tell you, this is the first time since I've written this book that I've been engaged in a conversation that really points to my intentions and what I think the value of the thing is. And I just want to tell you, it's very moving to me to have someone else talk with such dignity about this, because I'm just grateful. That's all I'm telling you.
Sure.
You do a beautiful job of
well, thanks.
Articulating what this thing is about.
Right. And I think I can well understand how someone might take this book up and focus on the silly, especially if it is a radio interview, and that's kind of the tone of the program overall. And again, there's a lot to laugh at, a lot to enjoy on that kind of level, but there's a lot of profundity here as well. And the way that it is wrapped up, as I said earlier, in kind of a light touch, I think really makes it go down easily. So I enjoyed this quite a lot. You have some interesting thoughts that I think go on from there in terms of what the sort of struggle of life is for so many. And one of the things you say at one point, I think it's in the chapter about the human brain, is when you say life is a lovely, complicated accident. Our sweet little miraculous brains just do not have what it takes to understand it. So I guess, you know, part of what this book is about is kind of helping all of us along the way, trying to kind of make sense of all of this. In what way do you see so much of human life as kind of an accident? Or at one point, I think you talk about so much of life being chaotic and random. What leads you to look at life that way? And why do you think it's, in a sense, helpful for the rest of us to look at life that way?
At the heart of this book is my core belief that life is chaos, and that realization was set in stone when I was 11 years old, and both of my parents died. That's what I carry with me, that you must make the best of what you have, because it's out of your control. Any organized thought that you apply to reality is your organized thought. Reality doesn't care what you think. Reality behaves in ways I know I can't figure out. I can marvel at it, but I can't. And I make my shape of it, but I can't do anything about it. And so, without being too Pollyanna-ish about it, if you're having troubles, so's everybody. And find in the chaos. A little place that where you can become more contented and just keep moving towards contentment. Everybody can do that. And this book, I'm much better at constructing my worldview than spontaneously expressing it.
Right. No, I think I get what you're saying. There's something on the printed page versus trying to concoct all this. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so that's what I'm stuck with. And that's why even in interviews like this, I feel tongue-tied and I feel inarticulate. And when I sit down to write, that is the happiest place I get to have.
Right. In the chapter called Chaos, you write, "Everything happens not by design, but by cold-blooded, heartbreaking randomness. We shape our lives from whatever debris has been swept by chance into our cosmic dustpans." In a nutshell, life is...
Why couldn't I have said that? Jeez.
Right. In a nutshell, life is making order out of chaos. I mean, that's what the business of living is all about.
Moments ago. So, thank you for reading that.
I want to ask you about something you say in your chapter called The Brain, or Brains. It's an image you create of how you think the human brain, at least for the most part, operates. You write at one point, "I've come to know that my brain is not really mine. It's like a little pet that lives in the kennel of my head." So that is a uncommon way of thinking about the human brain. So how does that help you kind of make sense of yourself in the world by thinking of the brain in that way? In what way is the brain like a little pet living in the kennel of our head?
It's on display right now. When I'm preparing for an interview like this, which is only recently and attached to this book, I can't count on my brain delivering to me the paragraph that I want to say. And so I'm aware that, and that's why I carry this little notepad, because I will have a thought that would not come if I weren't looking at something that gives me a notion, and then I write it down in my little notebook. If I didn't do that, I'd wonder, what the hell was that thing that I was thinking about. The brain, it does seem like a separate entity. Think about when you you prepare for a play, you learn all of these lines. How is that done? How do you have to tell your brain that, okay, now look, this time we're memorizing stuff, okay? Get the memorizing feature going. It is such a mysterious glob up in your head, and it just seems to have a life of its own. At least mine does. And when I hear people on the radio answering questions in full paragraphs and zigzagging here and there, I am in awe because my brain can't do that. And so it just, the notion of that's a little pitch in your head that you say, okay, go in and bring me out this idea. And it goes in, it'll bring out the idea you want, or it won't, because it can't find it. It can't. You're looking for a word, and you can't retrieve it. And so it just seems like, okay, brain, how about letting me go to sleep? Can we do that? And so that's the way it feels with me. And my brother, my oldest brother, has had a stroke, but it's an interesting stroke. He can write, but he cannot read. And he tries to write things, which he can do, but then he can't read what he has written. And that's his own special stroke. Some little thing in his brain got clogged up, and he can write, but he can't read. What? It alerts you to the fact that the brain is so complicated and so delicate that enjoy it while it's working well, because it's going to slow down. It's not, you can't do anything about it. It will tell you. You won't tell it.
And you're right. Then that's something that is that none of us should ever take for granted. We're talking with Steve Adams about his book, What's What and What to Do About It, Answers You Didn't Know You Wanted to Questions You Didn't Know You Had. We're going to touch on just a couple of other things here real quick. In the chapter called Beliefs, in which you kind of come to that notion about how we sort out what it is that we believe and what we most believe or most sincerely believe about ourselves and life and so on, you create a really intriguing scenario that involves smashing things with a shovel. This is one of the most interesting parts of the whole book, and there's a lot of helpful food for thought here. Explain to our listeners this scenario that you set up in the chapter called Beliefs that involves smashing things with a shovel.
What page is this on? Because, once again, rather than describing it, it's like, suppose this were a song. I don't want to describe my song. May I read from it?
I think that would be fine.
Great.
Yes. I think that would be fine.
Why is it I can't find what? It's Beliefs. Well,
the chapter, yes.
My own.
Yeah, let me see if I can. Let me see if
I can. 27. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Sorry, buddy. 27.
Yep, that's right.
Okay. So this very arrogant guy has written a letter to Waldo, saying that he owns six different homes in different time zones, and he can glance at any page in a telephone directory and recite names in alphabetical order. He's got a sharp mind. He knows, he's confident that his values and what he knows to be true are constant and non-negotiable, and he's the beneficiary of the greatest idea on the face of the earth, capitalism. And so that's who Waldo is responding to. And Waldo says this, once again, Greg, don't tell me when enough is enough, okay? Mm-hmm. Thank you for your, dear Anonymous, thank you for your refreshingly direct letter. You are absolutely correct. I do think you and a June bug are equal miracles. You say that success depends upon knowing. We differ on this, and that I think knowing is just another word for I'm done thinking about it. You say your values are constant. We differ on this, too, and that I think values are a flimsy product of random circumstance. And in hopes of making my point, I'm inviting you to play a fabulous game I've devised called Which Would You Smack with a Shovel? The rules are simple. I'm going to give you an imaginary shovel and an imaginary table upon which I am going to place different sets of imaginary things. Okay, Anonymous, here we go. I'm now placing on the table a small grayish stone and a beautiful living butterfly. Raise your shovel, please, and now bring it down hard upon one of them. Good show, Anonymous. You've made it clear that you value life and beauty more than you value non-life and grayishness. Okay. Let's brush the bits of the stone off the table. And next to the same beautiful butterfly, let's place another small stone, much like the last one, but shaped, when viewed from a particular angle, like a lopsided heart. This stone belonged to your great-grandfather. It was given to him by your great-grandmother, who found it one clear summer day when they were courting. And until his death, your great-grandfather kept that stone in the right front pocket of his trousers, rubbing it with his thumb whenever he needed soothing. Okay, raise your shovel, please, Anonymous, and bring it down hard upon just one imaginary object. Oof. Sorry, butterfly. So much for beauty and life. But hooray for sentimental value. Okay, let's sponge the residual dust of the beautiful butterfly off the table and replace it next to your great-grandpa's stone with another lump of stuff also found in the ground. It's a diamond. I have no idea how much it's worth. Okay, Anonymous, raise your shovel, and now please smack one of the two imaginary objects on the table. Well, I know you're a smart guy when it comes to money, Anonymous, and so I'm guessing that you brought the shovel down on your great-grandpa's stone just in case the diamond is worth a lot. And I have wonderful imaginary news for you. The imaginary diamond is real. In fact, it has been assessed by imaginary licensed gem brokers at over $750,000. Great going. Good judgment. You own that diamond now. Okay. Now on the table, I'm placing your fabulous diamond and an imaginary mongrel dog donated by your local ASPCA. And under the drum roll of an imaginary professional drummer, please raise your shovel and do your thing. Well, as we wrap the poor imaginary poochie in a sheet, I must deliver to you some disturbing news. The imaginary licensed gem brokers were crooks. They made off with the real diamond and in its place put a chunk of well-cut glass. I don't blame you, Anonymous, for hurling your imaginary shovel into the imaginary bushes. Shall I continue?
Mm. I think we get the gist of this experiment.
Good. Okay.
So this is an experiment to help sort out what it is that we most value, and I think part of the point you're making is that what we value most is not a simple matter. And sometimes what we end up valuing in terms of something over something else, sometimes there are some surprises there.
Absolutely. You know, what you consider to be yours becomes special. You pick out earrings for your partner, and suddenly those earrings are of all the billions of earrings, those are the special ones. And it's all just in your head. And so I guess that's you know, you're making sense out of the chaos, and it calms you down.
Mm. Well, you go on to explore all kinds of other intriguing topics and issues in very, very intriguing fashion. Towards the very beginning of the book, you say that you really hope that people will read this book over a period of time in short bursts, rather than sitting down and digesting it in one sitting. Why do you think it's better to read the book in this fashion, kind of slapdash fashion, a little bit now, a little bit later, a little bit after that?
I think when you get any book, this is different. This is not a novel, but novels, short story books, they teach you to turn the page quickly, because if the novel is written well, that's what you want to do. You want to find out more and more about this person you're just learning about, or about the situation, the problem that this person has to resolve. In this particular book, it takes the shape of an advice column, and so each chapter presents itself kind of like music on a record album. You go from one cut to the next cut to the next cut. There's no relationship there's very little relationship between one chapter and the next. I had a person tell me that, I started reading this book and I was reading, and I got halfway through it and I thought, well, wait a minute, I'm supposed to slow down. And when the person did slow down, it was much more enjoyable, because that is the way it should be read. It should be sipped and not gulped, and because there's hopefully it will spark in the reader their own thoughts about this kind of stuff, and by either disagreeing with me or agreeing strongly or having some questions, it will sharpen the opinion of the reader, not necessarily to my point of view, but to a point of view. And so so that's that. Mm.
Well, this book really does get us thinking, and exactly in that sort of way. I mean, it's easy to toss off those words and not really mean them, but I really do mean them in the very best, richest sense of the word. This book is thought-provoking, and I find myself, in the best sense of the word, really haunted by it. I mean, returning to a lot of the questions that you raise and explore. The book, again, is What's What and What to Do About It. Answers You Didn't Know You Wanted to Questions You Didn't Know You Had, published by Seven Stories Press, and the author, Steve Adams, under his pseudonym Waldo Mellon. Steve Adams, thank you so much for giving the world this really wonderful book. I thoroughly enjoyed it and enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Greg, thank you so much. I wish we were neighbors.
Next week, we have some very interesting morning show interviews that are scheduled that I hope you will enjoy. Among them, on Monday, you'll be hearing from Catherine Alamang Jacob, the author of a book that takes us back into the so-called Gilded Age and tells the story of Sam Ward, who was one of the most famous and effective lobbyists of his generation. The book is called King of the Lobby, The Life and Times of Sam Ward, Man About Washington in the Gilded Age. Among the other interviews next week that I'm very excited about, on Wednesday, you'll hear my interview with concert pianist Jeremy Denk. He was very recently a guest of Terry Gross on Fresh Air. He has written an amazing memoir about his life as a musician called Every Good Boy Does Fine, a love story